The question presented in this appeal was recently before the court in Julian versus Hanna, where the court described the argument in that case as overreach. Because in Julian versus Hanna, it was possible to resolve the case without reconsidering or considering whether this court should continue its position as an outlier circuit on the existence of a Section 1983 action which accrues at the successful conclusion of criminal proceedings. That's the question presented in this case. There's no question about the availability of an Illinois remedy for malicious prosecution. The question here is whether there should be a Fourth Amendment, whether this court should join, I think, the eight other circuits which recognize a Fourth Amendment cause of action accruing at the successful conclusion of criminal proceedings. The arguments were thoroughly canvassed, were presented in Julian, and they're thoroughly presented in the brief. And if there are questions, I'd be pleased to answer them.
Well, if there's probable cause to arrest, to detain, and so on, doesn't that eliminate a Fourth Amendment claim?
It certainly does. In this case, there was not probable cause to charge Mr. Lovett with the felony case. Mr. Lovett was in custody on a misdemeanor. When the defendant officers learned that the misdemeanor had been filed against Mr. Lovett, they persuaded a prosecutor to file what we described as bogus felony charges. Mr. Lovett was then in custody on the bogus felony charges and the misdemeanor, but he fought the bogus felony charges for 17 months before he was found not guilty.
Now, there was probable cause for that initial misdemeanor arrest.
That we're not challenging that. And the misdemeanor arrest, though, could only have resulted in 1 year of imprisonment if he had pleaded guilty, and he had a right to go to trial within 120 days of when he was incarcerated. Once the felony charge was filed, he didn't have a right to a speedy trial in the misdemeanor case. The misdemeanor case was held in abeyance because the prosecutor elected to proceed on the felony case. The Illinois speedy trial rule allows, I think, 160 days on the misdemeanor after the felony case is resolved. And the felony case is resolved after 17 months of pretrial detention. And the next day, the misdemeanor case was dismissed. So it's clear, I think, that this man was deprived, restrained of his freedom of movement for some period of time because of the bogus felony charge.
So the Fourth Amendment claim, just so I can be clear on it, that you're attempting to bring requires that there be a seizure. And what was the seizure?
Seizure, he was locked up. He was in the Cook County Jail and unable to go anywhere. It wasn't like he was coming to court for court appearances every month that he was restrained of his liberty because he was on bail. That's not this case. This case is he was at the Cook County Jail for 17 months. He was a prisoner. It seems like that should be a deprivation of his freedom of movement, which should be a Fourth Amendment violation, and which should accrue if there's going to be, like virtually every other circuit agrees, a 1983
act. How did the felony charge extend his period in jail?
It took 17 months for the felony charge to go to trial. He could not have been held for 17 months on the misdemeanor charge because it was punishable only by up to 1 year in jail. And he was held for 17 months fighting the bogus felony case. When he was acquitted of that, then he was able to get released on the misdemeanor charge. He didn't have any right to do anything with the misdemeanor charge. He was essentially in custody he was in custody because of the felony charge for 17 months. That could not have been held for that long on the misdemeanor charge.
But was there probable cause for the felony charge?
No, we say that the felony charge was bogus, that it was contrived by the defendant officers because they were out to get Mr. Lovett because he had complained about them, because he had, they thought, beat another case that they had tried to bring against him earlier, and they filed what we allege is a false police report saying that the alleged victim of the battery, the aggravated battery, the alleged aggravated battery, made these statements accusing Mr. Lovett of doing things when she didn't actually do it, that they just put the case together because they wanted to keep him locked up. The question that was conceded by the appellant in Julian, which the court didn't reach, was whether if there is a Fourth Amendment claim which accrues at the successful conclusion of criminal proceedings, is malice an element of that? And the appellant in Julian said, yes, it should be, but we think it should not be. The Fourth Amendment is an objective standard, and there shouldn't be anything about malice in it. We would ask the court to make clear, to join the other circuits that recognize a Fourth Amendment claim that accrues at the successful conclusion of criminal proceedings. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Flaxman. So, Ms. Beyer? Beyer? Mr. Beyer, sorry.
May it please the court, this court should affirm the judgment of the district court. I'd like to start with the Fourth Amendment malicious prosecution issue before briefly turning to the issue of elaboration appeal, the Reynolds issue. Mr. Lovett concedes to this court that there was probable cause to arrest him, to detain him, to prosecute him for a misdemeanor charge of domestic battery. His complaint is here that a Fourth Amendment malicious prosecution claim should be allowed because an additional charge was brought, that a felony domestic battery charge was brought. But that runs, we believe, squarely into the issue that the Supreme Court addressed in Devenpeck, that turns on issues that could differ from place to place, time to time, that certain nuances of state law could be determinative of whether a Fourth Amendment claim could prevail. That a prosecutor believing, whether rightly or wrongly, that a felony charge could be brought when there was undeniably probable cause for a misdemeanor charge, that the mere fact that the prosecutor mistakenly believed that the felony charge is properly brought could sustain a Fourth Amendment claim. And we believe that under the reasoning in Devenpeck, that is
Mr.
absolutely foreclosed. Well,
Mr. Flaxman said there was no probable cause to believe there was a felony.
Yes, he does say that. He does not dispute that there was probable cause for the misdemeanor charge.
Yes, but he says that without a felony charge, the defendant couldn't have been held for more than a year.
We don't believe that's correct. We don't believe that's even been properly fleshed out with facts either in the complaint or in the elaborations that Mr. Lovett has offered on appeal.
But if the maximum sentence for a misdemeanor is a year, then how could you hold him for more than a year?
Your Honor, this turns, we believe, on the language of the Illinois Speedy Trial Act, which sets forth certain time periods. I believe it largely reflects, I'm not sure if it completely mirrors the constitutional right to a speedy trial, but it provides certain time periods for...
He can be held pre-trial for some period of time under the Illinois law, right?
Yes, and this is...
So if he were held at pre-trial and then found guilty and sentenced to the entire year, he would ultimately have served more than, with regard to that charge, although the sentence itself might only have been a year, he would have been in custody for.
That's correct. It'd be, I guess, basically time served would be the ultimate result of, in a circumstance
such as
that.
Would he be required to get the time served, or would that be tacked on?
Sorry,
would he be required to get time served, or would, under Illinois law, or would that be just tacked on to the, not be related to the sentence?
I don't think it'd be related to the sentence, but I'm unfortunately not familiar with that nuance of Illinois sentencing law. But turning to the Illinois Speedy Trial Act,
I wouldn't dismiss it too quickly, because that's the argument. He couldn't have been in for longer than a year. If he's not going to automatically get time served, credit for time served, then he could serve whatever the Illinois law provides at pretrial detention.
I'm not attempting to dismiss that. I'm sorry. I was attempting to explain it in context of the Illinois Speedy Trial Statute, which sets forth a presumptive, I believe it's 120 days, but also contains in Section E, this is 725 ILCS 5/103-5, Section E. That section contains an anti-piggybacking provision, as I would describe it, where if an individual is incarcerated simultaneously for different charges, that statute, that section specifically provides that the criminal charges have to be brought within the 120-day or 160 days and if the individual is out on bail. I believe the distinctions between bail and being incarcerated without bail. Has to be any charge for any trial regarding relating to any of those charges brought simultaneously has to occur within the time period, the shortest time period for any of those statutes or any of those charges. If an individual was charged with a misdemeanor, 119 days went by without any excludable time under the Speedy Trial Act, then a felony charge was brought, that would not automatically extend in any way the speedy trial period. A trial would still have to be commenced within the speedy trial period. It turns on issues of excludable time, which Mr. Lovett simply does not address in his brief, does not explain in any way in his, even his elaboration. He does not show how those excludable times were not properly counted against him. That it's just, there's just nothing in the record. There's nothing in this, nothing in the complaint. There's nothing in the brief on appeal to say why that the time frame for the misdemeanor was not extended. He's made no argument whatsoever that he was not properly brought to that the time frame for his misdemeanor charge had expired by the time his felony trial began. And we believe that's fatal to that because, again, without a showing of harm, he simply cannot prevail on his claim.
So is it your position that no Fourth Amendment malicious prosecution claim can exist under this court's precedence, or just that Lovett has failed to bring that claim?
We believe both, actually, that this court has time and again explained in numerous opinions why a malicious prosecution claim under the Fourth Amendment, as well as the Due Process Clause, which Mr. Lovett rightfully does not invoke here, why such a claim cannot survive, that it runs into basic textual problems with the language of the Fourth Amendment, which makes no mention of prosecutions. It mentions searches and seizures. And this court has explained that seizure is best understood as a point in time, as a particular event, not a continuing event. That there's no such thing as a continuing seizure, which would be necessary to sustain, we believe would be necessary to sustain a Fourth Amendment malicious prosecution claim. Mr. Lovett does not challenge. He offers no challenge to this court's rejection of the continuing seizure doctrine, and that doctrine's received
Mr. Flaxman said there was no probable cause for charging him with a felony, yet that charge extended his time in jail. So why wouldn't that be a Fourth Amendment claim?
That would not be a Fourth Amendment claim, even if it did extend his time in jail, because of the existence of probable cause to detain, to seize.
But he said there's no probable cause to charge Lovett with a felony.
That's correct. That is what he has alleged, but he does not dispute that there was probable cause on an offense, on the misdemeanor offense.
I know, but the misdemeanor wouldn't justify indefinite imprisonment.
No, we aren't claiming that it would.
Well,
but
I don't understand. Your proposition is that a person facing a maximum sentence of a year can nevertheless be held in jail for more than a year?
Depending on the circumstances, that would seem
what
to be...
What sense does that make? Why doesn't the state say, if a year has gone by and a fellow's in jail and hasn't been tried yet, then what basis they have for continue? He served the full punishment, the maximum punishment. So how can you keep him in jail? I don't get it.
Well, we admit that may be problematic under state law, but as a matter of constitutional law...
Well, I don't
law,
get it. I don't understand that. There's no I don't see what the basis is for holding him in jail for more than a year if the maximum sentence is a year.
The basis would be under the Illinois Speedy Trial Act.
What sense does it make? He's already served his maximum punishment. So what's the point in keeping him in jail so he can have proceeding to determine whether he should have spent that year in jail? What's that about?
But again, Your Honor, that would run into the problem recognized in Devenpeck, that it would turn on whether a state defines a certain crime as a misdemeanor or not.
I don't understand you. If the maximum sentence for a misdemeanor is a year, then after you've been in jail for a year, what's the basis for continuing to hold you?
Under the Fourth Amendment, it would be the existence of probable cause.
Probable cause for what? How can there be probable cause to hold a person after he has satisfied the maximum sentence he could have been?
But, Your Honor, even under the Fourth Amendment, and even an initial seizure that was not authorized by state law in the first instance is not a violation of the Fourth Amendment. If the authorizing statute that creates a certain offense does not authorize detention, even then that does not constitute a Fourth Amendment violation to seize a person for a violation of that statute. I see my time is expired.
Well, I don't understand you. It's not a, there's no Fourth Amendment violation. What, to seize a person for a non, when there's no statutory basis for the seizure?
Not for when there's no statutory basis for the seizure, but when a statute sets forth a particular crime but does not authorize anything beyond perhaps a fine of some sort. Seizing a person under that does not violate the Fourth Amendment, because again, that would make the Fourth Amendment analysis turn on one state defines a particular crime as a felony, another one decides that, you know, for instance, marijuana as it stands right now in different parts of this country, it may be a felony, it may be a misdemeanor, it may be entirely legal. But the Fourth Amendment doesn't turn on such distinctions that the Supreme Court has recognized are entirely arbitrary, that nuances of state law from place to place. And if a person can be seized constitutionally when a statute does not authorize a seizure.
Suppose a person gets a parking ticket. Can you put him in jail for determination of whether he actually parked illegally?
As I understand the Fourth Amendment doctrine, that would not be a violation of the Fourth Amendment. It may be obviously problematic under state law, but it would not be problematic under the Fourth Amendment.
I don't get that.
And then I want to clarify something. Are you conceding there was no probable cause for the felony?
Oh, we are not conceding that there was no probable cause. We are just stating that it's irrelevant. We have to take the facts in the complaint as true, of course, under this procedural posture. But as we explain in our brief, even the complaint didn't set forth any facts that would raise to a plausible set of facts that would show a plausible claim that there was a lack of probable cause. All Mr. Lovett offered here was a conclusion that his arrest was without probable cause. He offered absolutely no facts until appeal to support that, to raise it beyond possible to plausible, as the Supreme Court has put it in Twombly and Iqbal. There was just nothing there. It seemed the only real elaboration was, at most, was on the issue of malice, was that the officers acted with malice because of a previous complaint against them. But otherwise, there was...
Well, suppose someone leaving the courthouse sneezes and a policeman arrests him. There's no offense. There's no crime of sneezing. There's no Fourth Amendment violation.
Oh, of course not. That would certainly be a Fourth Amendment violation if there's no
statute
at all.
Why is it a fourth violation to be holding someone beyond a year who can't be punished for more than a year? What's the difference between can't be punished at all for sneezing and can't be punished for more than a year in jail for a misdemeanor?
It would turn on the fact that there's no, you know, again, the probable cause analysis turns on the existence of an offense. It doesn't turn on the punishment for that offense. If an officer could reasonably believe that an offense has been committed in the sneezing incident.
Like a parking violation.
Like a parking violation, they could believe.
So a parking violation can put a person in jail for a year to await a proceeding on whether he really violated the parking regulations? Is that what you're saying?
I don't believe that's a fair interpretation of what we're saying, no.
Well, I think you are saying it.
I would disagree. I don't.
You're
believe
saying
that
as long as someone is the probable cause, there's probable cause that a person has committed an offense, you can put them in jail, even if it's not a jailable offense.
I don't believe it goes so that far. It turns on whether there was a authorization. Sorry, I'm getting muddled in my response. I'll try again. It turns on whether there is, first the analysis turns on whether there is an offense. If there is an offense, the seizure can occur, and that's the beginning and end of the Fourth Amendment analysis.
That's your answer to my question about the parking violation.
But that would raise an issue of due process. If an individual was held on a trumped up charge that no possible reasonable reading of the state law could permit, if the statute says you get $100 fine, and that is the extent of the possible punishment under law, and he's held for a year.
Well,
that
that's
may
exactly
be
exactly our case.
But Mr. Lovett does not raise a due process.
The maximum sentence is a year.
But that does not implicate, that would implicate concerns of due process. Again, that this court's distinction between the two. But Mr. Lovett has conceded that he is not raising a due process claim in this case.
It gets back to the question that Judge Posner was exploring with you. Is there a requirement under Illinois law, pretrial detention time, where you can't make bail, counts against the year sentence? Has to be credited as time served.
I am not aware, but I can submit supplemental authority if that would assist this court in reaching its decision here.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr.
We ask that you
Fryer. Mr. Flaxman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Illinois law does provide for credit for time spent in pretrial. And if you're locked up for a year in a misdemeanor case, the judge will let you out on bond because the judge will realize that there's no reason to hold this person. We can't punish him anymore. He's already been locked up for a year. So you would be released on bond, and it would be an obvious abuse of discretion for a judge to say, I'm holding you longer than a year on this one-year charge. One other point that I think got confused in Appellee's presentation with Devenpeck is that these were two occurrences. The misdemeanor charge was facts one. The bogus felony charge were facts two. If they arose out of the same occurrence, then the prosecutor would have made the misdemeanor case into a felony case, and that would have been We've had two cases pending. There were two different occurrences. One was bogus and one was based on probable cause but didn't lawfully justify in any sense 17 months of detention.
And could you articulate again, Mr. Flaxman, why you think we should in this case overrule Newsom?
Well,
or do you think we need to?
Well, I used to not think you needed to until Ray versus City of Chicago, which read Newsom as applying to any kind of malicious, any cause of action that arose when the criminal case was successfully resolved. Newsom, in a throwaway sentence, seemed to say that the Fourth Amendment claim, there was a Fourth Amendment claim, but it obviously time barred because this is 15 years after he was wrongfully convicted. And Newsom was also different because there was a conviction and then he was exonerated and you could plausibly say he had been denied a fair trial. When somebody is acquitted, he received a fair trial. He was locked up awaiting trial, but he was, the justice prevailed. The due process gave him the right result. He or she was found not guilty. And it's hard to say that you were denied due process when the result was the right way. If rules of due procedure are to achieve the right result, it achieved the right result. But you were detained, or Mr. Lovett was detained, for 17 months waiting for the right result, which should be an unreasonable seizure that he was held for that 17 months. And that cause of action should accrue when the criminal proceedings are successfully resolved in favor of Mr. Lovett.
But he does have a state court remedy.
That's correct. He does have a state court remedy. And in most other circuits, he also has a federal remedy. And the question is, why shouldn't people who live in Illinois not have the same federal remedies as people who live in Massachusetts or the District of Columbia or the other 32 states or 33 states that are in those circuits. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Flaxman.